Francesca de Rimini, whom we looked at extensively in the last lecture, can certainly be looked at as the poster child for the sin of lust, but I suppose we could also look at her as the poster child for the whole category of incontinence, the whole kind of general area. Lust certainly is the most interesting of the sins of incontinence, and also I think had a special place for Dante for what we already said, namely that this was something that he was himself implicated in, but also, as Augustine tells us in the Confessions, this is the sin that we're all implicated in. So kind of starting things off with lust makes a lot of sense in his scheme, but it's important for us to remember that depending on what the object is, the way in which you submit reason to desire, you can commit the sin in a number of other interesting varieties. So after lust, we get gluttony, which is incontinence, subjecting reason to desire as it relates to food and drink. After that, we have folks who are incontinent, who subject reason to desire with respect to money. We have the hoarders and the wasters. And then after that, one more category, those who are incontinent with respect to their own emotions, people who are either angry or sullen, people who are flying off the handle all the time or who are kind of enclosed down within themselves. So in those cantos, we move through the whole large area of incontinence and then are sort of heading toward the second big category, that of violence, but not before making a very important and very interesting stop along the way at a place that doesn't quite fit in to that scheme that we sketched out of incontinence, violence, and fraud.
And that's the sin of heresy. This scheme of incontinence, violence, and fraud, in fact, Dante tells us, is derived from classical sources. And because of that, there really is no place in this scheme for the sin of wrong belief, specifically Christian sin, if you will. And so we come to this place where the heretics are punished. But we need to say a couple things before we actually turn to the text. First of all, we tend to think of our dictionary definition of heresy as some rejection of the formal teachings of the church. And indeed, Dante gives us suggestions that the people he meets here are indeed guilty of that. But what's interesting here, and in several other places in Inferno, Dante does not talk about the sin in its literal form. We are not going to talk about theology and doctrine in this particular canto. We're going to talk about something very, very different. And therefore, as we look at the discussions that Dante has with two different sinners in this particular place, we want to ask ourselves, what do these discussions of politics and poetry have to do with the sin of heresy? Why would that be a relevant topic of discussion, not just for Dante the Pilgrim, where it's obvious because he was politician and poet, but why would it be a good conversation to have with people who are there being punished for heresy?
Notice also that what Bill said is important in terms of these two concerns. We have politics, something that they talk about, poetry, something that they talk about, and each has a kind of separate character who deals with Dante on the way. So in a way, dramatically, poet has kind of expanded the canvas a little bit. When you see the pilgrim encountering sinners, he sees not one, but two in this canto. So it's sort of a complicated, carefully orchestrated thing. We see Dante walking along, and all of a sudden what happens is...
Oh, Tuscan! Walking through our flaming city alive and speaking with such elegance, be kind enough to stop here for a while. Your mode of speech identifies you clearly as one whose birthplace is that noble city with which, in my time, perhaps, I was too harsh.
What we see is the pilgrim interrupted, encountered by the sinner rather than the other way around, by somebody who sort of grabs him and calls him a Tuscan, that is to say, I know what area of Italy you're from, by your mode of speech, as we would probably say, your accent. Right? What happens is that Dante is very confused. He turns around to Virgil as if to say, what's up? And Virgil says, turn around, that there guy is Farinata. Pay attention to him and see what he has to tell you.
It's interesting that the punishment here is to be inside flaming tombs. And as Dante had begun to walk through there with Virgil, all he saw was the tombs with flames. Now this guy sort of rises up, sort of waist high out of the tomb, and speaks in this big, deep voice with a commanding presence. In fact, Dante's comment is he's proclaiming his disdain for all this hell. And then Farinata begins to question Dante, wants to know a little bit more about him, more than just that he is a Florentine. He asks, to use Dante's words, half contemptuously, "And who would your ancestors be?"
Now that's a kind of curious question. Again, think about the context, walking along flaming tombs in hell. You see somebody, you recognize that person as a fellow citizen of your own part of the world, and the first thing you want to know, tell me about your ancestors. Say what? I mean, what is Francesca, what does Farinata think is going on here? Or what's he trying to get out of Dante? What's he doing? Dante, again, put on the defensive. I think what's really interesting here is the way in which Farinata kind of assumes control of the situation. Bill talked about the way he's sort of standing there majestically. I like to think of him as posing for the statue of himself, which he's hoping one of these days Florence is going to erect in his honor. Sort of all puffed out, and making sure that Dante is sort of backpedaling here when he does this wonderful gesture of lifting up his brows a little, as he puts it, and says, "Bitter enemies of mine they were, and of my ancestors and of my party. I had to scatter them not once, but twice." Well, what is going on there?
So we have this situation where, you know, to put it real simply, here are two guys from the same hometown, a long way away from their hometown. We're a long way from Florence. And we might expect that a conversation between two Florentines would be about their Florentineness, if you will, what they have in common as citizens of the same country. But no, notice what this question is all about is, first of all, is your family as good as mine? Where the answer, by the way, almost inevitably will be no, is the Alighieri family, that was Dante's family name, really as good, we know who this fellow is, Farinata, of the Deluberti family. And then, secondly, because party politics in Florence usually fell along family lines, all the family members are of the same party, usually, he's also basically asking, what side are you on in the factional conflicts in Florence? Are you on my side, or are you on somebody else's side? So here, where we might expect something that will unite, all we get is division. Division socially and division politically.
It's kind of interesting, in fact, that Farinata seems to make the assumption here that because Dante is on the wrong side of all of these things, that somehow that's better, because it gives him the opportunity to show off. I mean, essentially what he's doing is saying, ha-ha, all right, I'm better than you, my ancestors are better than you, and my party's better than you, all right? And says that just to prove it, I had to scatter them not once but twice. Well, this takes us back to that Guelph-Ghibelline struggle that we talked about in our introductory lectures.
It turns out Farinata is a Ghibelline in a city that was normally dominated by Guelphs. But twice, in 1248 and in 1260, in fact, the Ghibellines did, as we know from our earlier lecture, temporarily kick out the Florentines. And it was during one of those periods when the Florentines were, or the Guelphs were kicked out, when Dante, in fact, was born. So he is correct in saying, my party kicked out your party twice, going back to the good old days of 1248 and 1260.
Now, it's interesting to see how Dante responds to this. The problem, again, as we saw in the earlier lectures, if you happen to be somebody like Farinata, who was a Ghibelline, is that that victory, or those victories, didn't last very long. And the Guelphs came back, and as subsequent history would have it, they came back permanently. Now, Dante knows this, okay, and it's apparent that Farinata doesn't. So here we have this my old man can beat up your old man kind of conversation going down in the middle of these tombs, in the middle of this barren part of hell. And the thing that's very interesting is not simply that Farinata is baiting Dante, but that Dante is rising to the bait. And so Farinata is sort of there, you know, chalking up the victory points. And Dante answers saying, yes, they were expelled, but only to return from everywhere, I said, not once, but twice, an art your men, however, never mastered. So that from Dante's point of view, the pilgrim, it's kind of as though he's given a knockout punch to Farinata and Farinata's position. Yeah, your ancestors might be all these noble folks and all of that, but guess what? They're out of here, and they've not learned the art of coming back. Ha, ha, ha.
Because, in fact, in 1300, when the poem is set, the Guelphs are in firm control. The Ghibellines have been not in power in Florence for more than 30 years. So Dante can trump the history card with the present card, if you will. It's also interesting to note that he refers to coming back from exile as an art. Isn't that an odd word to use to describe this kind of political maneuver? We might think about the art of politics, and that's an appropriate term, but that's not the way that Farinata is using it. This art here is simply the muscle to kick out the fellow citizens of yours that for the minute you think of as the bad guys.
Now, at this point, there's kind of a suspension of the action here. And before we pick it up, just to sort of suggest that here, what this tells us is as much about Dante as it does about Farinata, in the sense that by 1300, or at 1300, when the poem is set, Dante, recently emerged from a dark wood of error, seems to be so caught up in partisan politics that he can't help but argue on Farinata's own level, that he's sort of doing exactly what Farinata is doing. But of course, think about where it's gotten Farinata. And so here you have Dante ready to go toe-to-toe with him and, you know, drops him with a good right hand. But then another character appears who complicates issues by talking to Dante about something else.
What we find here is that another fellow occupant of the same tomb appears, not nearly as majestically as Farinata, but just sort of putting his chin over the edge of the tomb. It's an interesting contrast of these two souls who are going to be living eternally in this tomb. And he has a question for Dante, too.
Two mates from hell.
If it be great genius that carries you along through this blind jail, where is my son? Why is he not with you? Now, there are a lot of ways in which this is an interesting question. First of all, does he have the right premise? Is Dante in hell because of Dante's great genius? Well, we know differently, of course, because we know that in some ways Dante's here because he's so messed up that without this journey, he's going to be unable to be oriented toward God and away from self and sin. So we know that the premise has to be disputed. But given the premise, if you're here because it's some sort of reward for genius, where's my kid?
And it turns out that Dante, from this and from recognizing the guy as well, figures out that his kid turns out to be an old friend of Dante's, a fellow poet, obviously a fellow Florentine. And so Dante answers and says to him, the one waiting over there, that is to say, of course, Virgil, guides me through here, the one perhaps your Guido held in scorn. Dante, in other words, is accepting the premise of this as of now unidentified speaker, and says, yeah, he doesn't like Virgil as much as I do, and that's why I'm here. So Dante's kind of accepting the notion that he's there as a kind of reward rather than as sort of, as we said, a shock, a sort of shock treatment for the soul.
Dante knows who this is. He tells us this, that he recognizes this soul from his positioning and from his question. So that's why he can answer specifically with the name of this man's son. But it's interesting to notice that Dante simply says this in the past tense as part of the conversation. Maybe your son's not along because he held Virgil in scorn, a very common way of speaking. But look at the way that this guy, whom we know is named Cavalcante, responds. Instantly, he sprang to his full height and cried, "What did you say? He held. Is he not living? The day's sweet light no longer strikes his eyes." And when Dante pauses briefly before answering, because as it turns out, Guido is still alive, he falls back down in the tomb, and we never see him again.
So here you have this person who essentially talks from the tomb in order to make mischief with Dante, misinterprets what Dante says, and goes back into the tomb before there's any response. And while Dante's sort of puzzling about this, a little slow on the uptake, okay, and wasn't able to say, no, your son is still living, we go back to the first conversation. It is this remarkable comedy of errors, really, that's being orchestrated down here. Farinata and Dante are talking. Cavalcante talks with Dante. Cavalcante disappears back into the tomb. Farinata picks up where he left off, and he picks up exactly where he left off. In other words, he picks up as if, not even as if, he picks up not recognizing the existence of the other person and not recognizing any break in the conversation. He goes right back to what Dante had last said to him, namely the art of coming back after being kicked out of Florence, and says to Dante, he merely picked up where we had left off, "If that art they did not master," he went on, "that gives me greater pain than does this bed. But the face of the queen who reigns down here will glow not more than 50 times before you learn how hard it is to master such an art." Well, goodness gracious, what is going on there?
Remember, we've played the history card. That is to say, Farinata said, "My party beat up your party and kicked him out twice." Dante has played the present card. Right now, it is the Guelphs who are in power and not the Ghibellines. We're in. You guys are out. What is it, then, that's left? What card can Farinata play?
Turns out he has a very nice trump card here. He has the future card. And what you have here is a very strong, perhaps the strongest in the Inferno, prediction of Dante's coming exile. Okay? The face of the queen who reigns down here, in the darkness of hell, one never mentions the sun, so time is reckoned by the moon, and that queen who reigns down here will glow not more than 50 times, meaning 50 months will pass, before you learn how hard it is to master such an art. The art, remember, is the art of coming back after you've been kicked out. So here we have, in a very interesting, though indirect way, a prediction precisely of what's going to happen to Dante down the road.
It's important to say, of course, that Dante is going to hear over and over again various hints about his exile, which takes place the year after the poem is set, but he won't have it sort of laid out flat, clear, and unequivocally until he gets all the way to heaven. Another reminder that we simply can't take Inferno and go home and say we understand what Dante's about and how the Commedia works.
And notice also this is a nifty way of showing, by example, how it is important that we keep in mind all the time the difference between the poem when it was written and the poem as it said as a journey. Dante, the poet, is constructing this in exile, all right? The pilgrim, at the height of his own political power, hears essentially a prediction of that exile. From the point of view of the poet, it's history. From the point of view of the pilgrim, it's prophecy. And so one of the advantages of setting the poem in 1300 then becomes all of the ways in which Dante is able to use the history between 1300 and the time he writes the poem as a kind of prediction of the future.
After this past, present, future argument takes place, Farinata has some questions, still more questions, in fact, to ask Dante. Why is it that your party, the Guelphs, are so tough on my family? Because what we know is that in 1280, the Ghibellines were allowed to come back to Florence from exile. They weren't given power, but they were allowed literally to move back in the city. The one exception was the family of Farinata. Farinata was by that time dead. Why are you guys so tough on my family? Why don't you let them back in too? It's an interesting question, and Dante answers this way. The massacre and butchery that stained the waters of the Arbia red now cause such laws to issue from our councils.
Well, the massacre and the butchery that stained the waters of the Arbia red once again goes back to that year 1260 that we've already seen in this canto. Okay, that was one of the times that his ancestors scattered Dante's ancestors, because that was folks then, and if you're seeing these even now, the Battle of Monteperti, the famous Battle of Monteperti, in which a combination of Sienese forces and Ghibelline traitors in Florence allied to defeat the main army of Florence, Farinata chief among the traitors. And it took place at a place called Monteperti, where a little tiny stream called the Arbia was dyed red with the blood of those who died fighting there. So by this time, it's not like the memory has been forgotten. I even own a T-shirt that says "Remember Monteperti" on it. So you can imagine that if that's true in 2001, what it would have been like in 1300. So Dante is saying, look, you know, the reason that we don't like you so much is because you betrayed your city. And betrayal is not just some sort of abstract thing that happens. Betrayal is lots of us being killed. Okay?
Let's talk about how this betrayal happened. Remember, Farinata's already told us what he values. Me, my family, and my party. Well, those are parts of reality. But of course, Farinata also has some things in common with Dante. Fellow Florentine, fellow Italian, fellow Christian, fellow human. Farinata doesn't list any of those things. He only listed the things that divide. And what's interesting here is Farinata and his family and his party were in the minority. They were not in power in Florence. Okay, so what does he do? He goes to Siena, which was a Ghibelline city at the time, makes an alliance with Siena, the neighbor and enemy to the south of Florence, saying, I'll bring all the Ghibellines from Florence to fight alongside you guys when we take on my fellow Florentines who are not Ghibellines. So think about this. Why is your city so harsh toward my family? Because you're a traitor. Because you sold out Florence, because party, Ghibelline, meant more than city or nation, we would say today, Florence. How's that for a pretty good reason for the Florentines being sort of harsh on the family of Farinata?
And of course, like everybody else in hell, Farinata doesn't want to take blame, can't, finds a very interesting way of shifting responsibility here. He sighed. Okay, he's got all the political gestures down. He sighed, shaking his head. It was not I alone took part. I didn't do it all by myself. Nor certainly would I have joined the rest without good cause. Well, one wonders exactly what the good cause is, and I think, in fact, Farinata kind of explains it in the immediate next tercet. I alone stood up when all of them were ready to have Florence razed. It was I who openly stood up in her defense. What he's doing, of course, is saying that he was maybe not patriotic according to most Guelph standards, but here you go. They wanted to tear down the city stone by stone. The Sienese realized full well that they weren't going to have this opportunity all that often. And they said, we got them now, so let's just do them in. And I wouldn't let them do that. I stood up as the lone voice of truth and justice and the Florentine way and spoke for Florentine's defense, for Florence's defense. Again, a great patriot? Well, maybe not.
Perhaps simply self-serving. After all, this is a guy who wanted to rule. This was a guy who betrayed his country in order to try to rule it. And now his allies are saying, let me tear the place down. So although here he's saying, what a patriot I was, what a savior of Florence I was, I think we can also hear him saying, I want to rule this place. It's all about me. It's about me, my family, and my party. You take Florence out and you tear down my house. You get rid of my family. You don't give me the fruits of victory, which is power, not the power to do justice, not the power to care for Florence and its citizens, simply power for power's sake. And we need to hear that, even though we don't literally hear the words, as Farinata is telling his story. By the way, it's important to say that Farinata was sort of the co-victor in this battle, along with the head of the Sienese Ghibellines, whose name is Provenzan Salvani. You might expect, after all, since Dante's a Guelph and Provenzan Salvani and Farinata are Ghibellines, that probably Dante's got a pretty good place tucked away for this Sienese enemy down in hell, too. Well, we're going to meet Provenzan Salvani. We're going to meet him on the road to heaven. We're going to meet him in purgatory. He's among the saved. This is not about Guelphs and Ghibellines per se. This is about something much more fundamental. It's about what you value and the way you divide rather than unite.
Well, one of the things that sort of continues is this notion of division. Dante asks a question of Farinata, how come you could tell about the future? That seems odd. And Farinata's answer is that we have a kind of faulty vision down here. We can't see what's present. Can't see what's in front of us, we can only see what's at a distance. Now, that's a really neat trick to have, but of course, notice that it's not a trick that they're going to be able to keep for very long, because once time comes to a halt, in other words, once the last judgment is there, there won't be that future at all. They'll only be able to see the present, and what they'll be able to see is exactly and precisely nothing. So, in a way, it's something that is both a poetic device for the pilgrim to get info, but also says something about the nature of the punishment itself. Now, notice that Dante sort of continues with all of this. He says, you can understand, Farinata speaking, how all our knowledge will be completely dead at the time when the door to the future things is closed forever. Dante comes back and he says, then I, moved by regret for what I had done, said, now will you please tell the fallen one, his son is still on earth among the living. Okay, remember that intermediate speaker, that Cavalcante guy, said, my son, how come he's not here? Assumes that Dante is saying that he's dead, simply a bad mistake in grammar. Dante wants Farinata to fix it for him. But what we've seen in the dramatic interchange between the two of them here is that Farinata and Cavalcante don't so much as recognize each other's existence. They're stuck in the same tomb for all eternity, and they simply refuse to recognize that the other one exists. So what Dante is asking is never going to happen. But notice also this is a nifty way for the poet to talk about what happens when you take this idea of partisan politics and push it as far as it will go.
And that brings us back to the question we raised at the beginning. Why in the circle of the heretics do we talk about politics and poetry at all? Why is that the appropriate topic? Well, if we think about it, first of all, there's a lot of pride and a lot of factionalism, if you will, in politics and poetry. Why is Farinata so intense about his family? Is it because of justice? It's because it's his family. Is Cavalcante really a careful reader of poetry and therefore knows that his son is as good a poet as Dante? Or is it just the fact, it's my son? That we have these divisions in both of these characters in the realm of the arts, we might say more generally, and in the art of politics. And isn't that what heresy really is? In many ways, a good theological definition of heresy would be taking a part of the truth and assuming it's the whole truth and not letting anything else affect that. And if that becomes a pretty good definition, not quite a textbook definition of heresy, isn't that exactly what we're seeing here in Farinata, in Cavalcante, and in Dante the Pilgrim?
So here you have this wonderful canto in which Unlike, let's say, Francesca, where the subject, among the lustful is lust, the subject is politics and poetry, but in fact, everything they say embodies the nature of heresy and gives us a kind of interesting commentary on it, as well as sort of suggests to us that whether or not Dante the Pilgrim ever had a problem with formal heresy in any theological sense, this notion of partisanship was something that that affected him very strongly and that he needs very, very greatly to overcome.
And so now we head down a little bit further into the area of the sins of violence.